Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The world churns out 430 million metric tons of plastic every year. Much of it is dumped in landfills, burned, or turned up in places like rivers and oceans. Plastic pollution eventually finds its way into the bodies of animals and all of us. In a new ProPublica investigation, today's guest, Lisa Song, writes that for decades, the oil and gas industry has been selling recycling as a solution to curb the plastic pollution crisis. But fossil fuel and chemical companies have worked since the 1980s to spin the pollution crisis as a failure of waste management. They say all of this could be solved with recycling. But only 4% of plastic in the United States is recycled, just 4%. Industry leaders knew then what we know now. Traditional recycling would barely put a dent in the trash heap. It's hard to transform flimsy candy wrappers into sandwich bags or to make containers that once held motor oil clean enough for milk. The industry is now heralding nothing short of a miracle. It's an advanced type of recycling known as pyrolysis. Pyro means fire and lysis means separation. It uses heat to break plastics all the way down to its molecular building blocks. Lisa Song has been investigating the plastic pollution crisis. She covers the environment, energy, and climate change at ProPublica, an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. Lisa Song was part of the reporting team that revealed Exxon's shift from conducting global warming research to supporting climate denial, a series that was a finalist for the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Lisa Song is co-author of The Dilbit Disaster, Inside the Biggest Oil Spill You've Never Heard Of, which won a Pulitzer for National Reporting. Hi, Lisa. Thanks so much for joining us again, and thanks for your important reporting.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've done a lot of shows about recycling, but I think this number still shocks a lot of people, that the United States recycles just 4% of the plastic we produce. Can you tell us, where does that number come from?
Gosh, I think that number comes from the normal recycling industry. You know, there's a bunch of trade groups that represent the companies that haul away your curbside recycling and do the recycling. There's a lot of reasons why a lot of plastic isn't recycled. One of the biggest reasons is that, a lot of plastic products weren't designed to be recyclable. The way they're made by fusing different types of plastics together just makes it really hard, if not impossible, to recycle. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of American households just don't have access to recycling facilities.
What happens to all of that plastic? I mean, it's really shocking when you think about all the plastic that people use day in and day out, and only 4% of it is recycled.
Yeah, I mean, mostly what happens if your plastic isn't recycled is that it ends up in a landfill somewhere, or it's incinerated. And when you incinerate plastic, you release all kinds of horrible air pollution that causes a lot of health problems.
It's also hard to wrap your mind around 430 million metric tons of plastic every year, 40 million tons of plastic that's produced every year. How would you describe that? How can we picture that?
I mean, it's really hard to picture the sheer volume of plastic that we made. One of the statistics I read was that if you looked at all of the plastic the world has manufactured over decades, and if you turned all of that plastic into, thin plastic film, like the cling wrap you would use in your kitchen, that would be enough plastic to cover every inch of the earth. Wow. That's a pretty shocking statistic.
Right. Well, I want to give out the phone number because anytime we do a show about recycling, we get great questions from listeners. We're going to have Lisa Song on for the first half of today's show. So if you have any questions for her about the reporting that she's done on the plastic pollution crisis, and the fact that the United States recycles just 4% of the plastic we produce, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Lisa, before we dive in and talk about your piece about pyrolysis, let's discuss the piece you wrote in May called Plastic, Plastic Everywhere, even at the UN's, quote, plastic-free conference. In April, you attended a UN conference on plastic pollution in Canada. Representatives from about 170 countries gathered to tackle the plastic pollution crisis. You write, the challenge before delegates seemed daunting. How do you get hundreds of negotiators to agree on anything via live group editing, especially when representatives from fossil fuel and chemical companies would be vigorously working to shift the conversation away from what scientists say is the only solution to the crisis, curbing plastic pollution? You write that when you got to the meeting, you discovered those industry reps were not just the sideshow. They were welcomed into the main event. Tell us more about your experience at that conference.
Yeah, I mean, that conference is really important because nearly every country in the world is trying to work together and figure out a global treaty to curb plastic as a problem. The fact that nearly everyone recognizes the plastic crisis is huge and needs to be solved is a big deal. But what I found at the conference was that, you know, the way these international treaty processes go is they're very slow, very inefficient, and there is no real recognition officially that representatives of the plastics industry have a special vested interest in the outcome of the treaty, and they obviously want to sway the treaty in a way that affects their business as little as possible. And so when you're there, you see a lot of industry representatives there just hanging out with all of the government representatives. They have access to a lot of the meetings that all of the government representatives have. And as I found, reporters actually have less access to a lot of the rooms where the meetings are taking place than industry representatives do.
Can you tell us more about these plastic companies, the chemical companies? I mean, we're all familiar with Dow and ExxonMobil, for example. I'm guessing that a lot of us probably have not heard from or about a lot of these plastic, the companies that were at this conference. I mean, how big is this industry?
It is huge because it sort of encompasses the fossil fuel industry, you know, companies like ExxonMobil that make natural gas, they extract natural gas and crude oil, which they then use to make plastic. You also have the chemical industry itself, which is very much involved in making plastic. When you go out and buy something made of plastic today, like a soda bottle, it's made of plastic, but the bottle itself also has a ton of chemicals in it. And these chemicals are additives that are put into the bottle, for example, to make the bottle a certain color or to prevent the bottle from disintegrating quickly in sunlight. And a lot of these chemicals are toxic and bad for your health. So you've got the fossil fuel industry, you've got the chemical industry working together with very similar interests and goals. Then you also have other companies that do the actual molding of plastic. And these are going to be companies that are less of a household name. You know, one company, for example, is Berry Plastic. They make a lot of the actual physical plastic products that are out there in the world. And then sometimes you also have the actual brand name companies as well. So the companies that make chips and crackers and cookies, right? They package their products in plastic packaging. They're also going to be there at these UN conference and other similar venues. And so you have this entire coalition of companies that are dependent on making plastic and plastic products. And I mean, just to be clear, I didn't personally see Berry Plastic people at the conference or, you know, specific people from certain like food and beverage companies. But for sure, there were representatives of the fossil fuel and chemical industry there at the conference.
Can you tell us more about how these companies have worked since the 1980s to really spin this crisis as a failure of waste management, and then really pushing this idea that it's okay to buy all of this plastic because we all have that massive blue bin. And well, those of us that have recycling programs in our cities, and you can just throw the plastic in there and it'll be recycled.
Yeah, this is something that's been reported on a lot. A lot of news organizations, including NPR, have done investigations on this where they found historical documents from the plastics industry showing that as far back as the 1980s or 1990s, the industry knew they had a PR problem. There was plastic trash and litter in our rivers and streams and lakes, and people were starting to feel bad about plastic. And so the industry started promoting recycling as a solution, even though they knew that recycling could only solve a sliver of the problem. They were never under the impression that recycling alone could solve the plastic crisis, but they wanted the public to think that. And that is still true today, where recycling is often, you know, promoted as a kind of cure-all, but in reality, it's just not possible to use it as the key solution. And what we know from research and scientists and from the UN conference is that the only real solution has to include reducing the amount of new plastic that is made.
Today, we are speaking with Lisa Song, a reporter covering the environment, energy, and climate change at ProPublica. Lisa has done extensive reporting on the global plastic pollution crisis. She'll be with us for just over 10 more minutes. So if you have a question or comment about recycling and plastic, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Hiroko in Oakland who writes, "When will the onus of plastic pollution fall on the producers instead of consumers or those of us who are desperately trying to navigate the complexity of recycling?"
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There are a number of states that are proposing or implementing what are called extended producer responsibility laws. And these are laws that are about forcing the producer of the plastic product to pay for its disposal. Every state that is trying to do this has slightly different ways of how to do it. But Oregon, for example, I know is trying to finalize some of these laws into regulation. And so there are steps and policies where different places are trying to do this.
And the logical question would be, why is this taking so long? But, you know, we know how the system works. These companies have a lot of lobbyists and a lot of money, and they get in the way of this legislation because this is not a new problem. I mean, we've known about this for decades now.
Yes, definitely. You know, the plastics industry has a lot of money for traditional lobbying of policymakers, and they also have a lot of money to do marketing for consumers, advertising. Right. My story is about a newer type of recycling called chemical recycling or advanced recycling. And I've just been seeing in recent months advertisements from the plastics industry about how great chemical recycling is.
Well, let's dive in and talk about this. So you've got this extensive piece about what the plastic industry says is an advanced type of recycling, pyrolysis. You start off your piece writing about your obsession with a plastic cup. It was a small container that held diced fruit, the type thrown into lunch boxes, and it was the first product that you'd seen born of what is being touted as a cure for the crisis. So tell us more about this. What piqued your interest in learning about how this cup was made?
Yeah, so chemical recycling is sort of this umbrella term for several different types of technology to recycle plastic. But the main type of chemical recycling being used is something called pyrolysis. And that is just using heat to break down plastic back into its molecular building blocks and then making new plastic out of that. It's one of those things that sounds really great when you hear it. But I was starting to realize that I had never seen a real plastic product made through pyrolysis. So when I saw this press release about this cup that was made by ExxonMobil and a couple of other companies, I tried to follow up. You know, I contacted all three companies. I asked them, how many of these cups did you make? Where can I buy it? Where can I see it? And I just wasn't getting anywhere. And so that made me interested in investigating pyrolysis and figuring out, is it efficient? Does it actually work well? Are we doing a lot of pyrolysis? Is there a lot of plastic stuff being made through pyrolysis? And, you know, the answers I found were basically no. Pyrolysis is very inefficient. There's very little plastic product being made through pyrolysis right now. And yet it is being touted as this miracle cure.
So this is interesting. So you quote Print Pack, which turned the plastic into the cups. And Print Pack says this is a significant milestone. The fruit supplier Pacific Coast Producers called it the, quote, most important initiative a consumer packaged goods company can pursue. And then ExxonMobil is supporting the circularity of plastics, according to an August 2023 news release, citing a buzzword that implies an infinite loop of using, recycling, and reusing. These companies clearly know that people are tired of, I mean, that they want to figure out how to deal with this plastic pollution crisis. And so we hear these words a lot, reuse what you have. And it's so interesting that they're marketing this specifically to those of us who are trying to take action to ensure that we don't use as much plastic.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the advertising around pyrolysis is words like circularity, which implies that you can recycle something using pyrolysis again and again without end. And, you know, one of the biggest problems with pyrolysis I found is that just because of how the process works, when you make something new out of pyrolysis, what you make only has a few percent recycled plastic in the end. It's not possible to make something with a lot of recycled content through pyrolysis. But what the industry has done is they're using this kind of weird mathematical technique called mass balance to inflate the recycledness of a product. So that cup, for example, only physically contains a few percent recycled content. And yet it is being advertised as containing 20 or 30% recycled content.
So how can they get away with this? I mean, is anyone monitoring this industry?
This has to do with marketing regulations in the U.S. And right now, it's the FTC, the federal agency that controls how sustainability marketing is regulated. But because those rules are pretty old, they weren't written to account for things like chemical recycling and mass balance. So until the agency updates its rules, which it may do, which may happen soon, there is no kind of federal regulation of this kind of advertising at all.
So you wrote, it's easy to conclude that the cup was made with 30% recycled plastic until you break down the numerical sleight of hand that props up that number. It took interviews with a dozen academics, consultants, environmentalists, and engineers to help you figure that out?
Yes. This mathematical process of mass balance is really confusing and really hard to wrap your mind around. In my story, I tried to make it easier through these animations and illustrations that really kind of shows you how the mathematical shuffling happens. This is the sort of thing that most consumers have no idea about. Most people have never heard of mass balance or understand how it works. And you can imagine if you went to a grocery store and bought something that said, this is made with 30% recycled content via mass balance, most people would just assume that product contains 30% recycled plastic. They're not going to understand that the 30% is only possible because of this mathematical shuffling.
Right. Well, and I hope you can take the time to read and look at the graphics in Lisa Song's article. We've got a link at yourcallradio.org. She writes, "The world is drowning in plastic. Experts say we need to stop making so much, but the plastics industry is peddling a, quote, solution that works like magic. Don't be fooled." If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Steve who writes, "The question around all of this, is there any justifiable reason why all plastic products, particularly those that are otherwise disposed of after single or limited use, cannot be replaced on a practical level? That is, a transition that can garner wide and substantive support from the public and municipal and local agencies with material that is reusable and truly recyclable."
I mean, that's one of the solutions that a lot of people want, right? One of the reasons why so many people are pushing for a forced reduction in plastic manufacturing is that if the world could agree on limiting plastic production, then it would force companies and businesses and industries to innovate and set up new systems of reuse and refill. And this already does work in parts of the world. Right now, in parts of Africa, for example, there are still places where when you buy a bottle of soda, you are buying a glass bottle. And then after you drink it, you take it back to a refill station and it can be refilled and resold again. So these systems do exist. And there are limited versions of refill and reuse systems in the US and Canada. And this is something people are pushing for, is more investment in these types of systems to replace the single-use plastic that we're so dependent on.
We have a comment via Twitter. A listener writes, pyrolysis is just burning it up. It's bad for global warming and bad for air pollution. And there was a piece last November from Environmental Health News that says, The chemical recycling, this process is dangerous and dirty, emitting toxic waste back into the environment along the process. According to an analysis, typical emissions from pyrolysis, one of the most prevalent methods used in chemical recycling that involves breaking plastics down with high heat, include carcinogenic, polycyclic, aromatic hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds, chlorinated dioxins. PFAS may also be a contaminant of concern in chemical recycling output. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, we do know that pyrolysis is quite a polluting process. You end up getting a lot of toxic air pollutants from it. And overall, the environmental footprint of pyrolysis is much higher than what you get with regular plastic recycling. There have also been studies that show that making new plastic through pyrolysis is actually more greenhouse gas intensive than if you just made the plastic using new fossil fuels.
And yet, U.S. and European regulators have spent tens of millions of dollars subsidizing pyrolysis facilities.
Yes, there have been facilities built in different countries, partly through all kinds of federal government subsidies, whether it's direct financing or other kinds of incentives.
Well, before we end the segment, let's take a few calls. Let's go to Matt in Oakland. Hi, Matt. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, hi. I actually run a refill shop. It's called Re-Up Refills in Oakland. So I was really curious about the conversation. One question I have is really about single stream recycling. I remember as a kid, we used to have all the different bins you sort into. Now it seems like with the one stream, it's kind of hurting the bottom line of recyclers and kind of giving like a feel-good factor for the consumers, but really they're throwing in mostly trash in with the recycling. I'm wondering if you're seeing any shifts back to the multiple bin system.
Thank you. And before I let you go, Matt, I love that you have a refill shop. I think these are so important to support. Have you done much research on, you know, if more and more people go to these refill shops, I mean, we can save so much plastic from entering our environment.
Yeah, that's the hope. I think for us, it's a re-education of what we could perceive to be a solution for, you know, the plastic problem. But I think we're very much on board with the idea of producer responsibility as well.
Right. And so you want to know if there's a shift to single stream bins?
No, away from it. I feel like single stream's now the norm, but it really is just a license for consumers to kind of think that everything's recyclable rather than like knowing which bins are actually the appropriate bin for what your recyclable goes into. And it seems to be hurting the bottom line of the recyclers out there because they're spending so much time with sorting.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Okay, thank you. You're right. We throw the stuff in the bin and then it's taken away out of sight, out of mind. And yet all of this stuff has to be sorted. What are your thoughts on that, Lisa?
I don't know if there's a shift away from single stream recycling, but I do know that in parts of Europe, they sort their recycling much more than we do here. They'll have separate containers for metal, glass, and also several different containers for different types of plastic. And so something I've heard is that in places where they sort different types of plastic into different streams, the quality of the household recycling is better. And so therefore their recycling facilities are more efficient and they can recycle more plastic. So that's, you know, that's something that I've heard. It's just the quality of their recycling is just better.
Hmm.
But something that I think municipalities in the U.S. always want to consider is how easy is it for the consumer? So one of the reasons why many places embrace single stream recycling is because they feel like it's easier for the consumer to actually throw stuff in the recycling bin if we don't force them to sort beforehand.
Well, that's an important point, Matt. Thank you again for calling in. We don't have time to take your call, Greg. Sorry about that. But Greg wants to know, do you have any idea how much paper, metal, glass, other things that you can actually recycle? How much of that is successfully recycled? Any idea?
I don't have exact numbers, but I know that aluminum, for example, is very, very efficient. People like to recycle aluminum because it's more valuable just as a product. So it tends to be collected and recycled quite a bit. And when it does get recycled, it's also done very efficiently.
Lisa, what are you working on now around plastic pollution?
Some more plastics stories, kind of brainstorming several different stories, perhaps some update on the UN treaty process. That's a goal, something I'd like to do.
Well, thank you so much for your important reporting. Lisa Song is a reporter covering the plastic pollution crisis, the environment, energy, and climate change at ProPublica. And you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us, Lisa.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Thank you, you too. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the Biden administration's new proposal to protect 36 million workers from injuries related to heat exposure on the job. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.